In the early 1200s, you have a pretty famous guy who we know as Francis of Assisi, living in Assisi. And he had a vision that would actually change the course of his life while praying. He was praying in this sort of kind of broken down, dilapidated chapel there in Assisi. And he hears a voice. It says, "Francis, go and repair my church, which you see is falling into ruin." I'm sure it was Italian, not English, but there, Francis heard that and took the command quite literally and started doing brick and mortar and rebuilding the church there. And eventually kind of came around being like, well, maybe what God meant was bigger than that. Realizing that God was calling him possibly to be involved in restoring sort of the spiritual health of the church. It had gotten sort of corrupt in a way at the time. It had started going towards the things that eventually the Reformation will point out. And so Francis makes a goal to commit to humility. It's a big part of his writings. Poverty and a solidarity with the poor. Francis definitely had a bend in that direction. Observing and appreciating God's created order, devotion to Christ, all these things that are, in some levels, simple but radical. And Francis sparked a renewal movement in the church. There's actually a bit of a renewal that broke out there in Italy of Francis's work and his focus on Jesus and his focus on the poor really started changing things. And he saw what was broken and radically oriented his life around it. And I think Jesus is ushering in that kind of moment in Jerusalem of seeing just the dilapidation, the spiritual dilapidation of particularly the temple. And he's doing something about it. And he comes right off of, we saw the triumphal entry last week. He comes right off of that story. So, and all the people are singing Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It's Psalm 118. And the very next line, right after that line, is, and he will lead the procession up to the altar. So it's no surprise that Jesus goes straight to the temple right after this story. And we're going to see a series of confrontations between him and the Sadducees, the Pharisees. We'll talk about those groups in a second with a little bit of background. And we're going to watch Jesus cleanse the temple and some implications for us around today, what the fig tree symbolizes and why it might still be connected to the cleansing of the temple. And ultimately what that means for us, because we don't have the temple 6,500 miles away anymore. There's a new place that God dwells. But let's go through it. So the first section is that whole driving out the people in the marketplace. Now, when it comes to the origins of all this practice, it comes from a very practical place. Because you got to imagine, let's say you are a Jew living in the diaspora. So you're a Jew living in Turkey. You're in Asia Minor. And you're like, hey, we got to get down to Passover. Because God's called us to come and celebrate this big party for a week. But part of it is we need a spotless lamb. The priest has to approve of a spotless lamb that we can offer on that day. So now it's like, okay, do I have a lamb somewhere in Ephesus that I hope is going to be approved by the priest that I have to transport and hope it doesn't break a leg or anything like that all the way to Jerusalem to offer on that day? Or do I go, hey, I know there's a booth set up there with pre-approved lambs ready to go. The priests have already approved them. They're going to be spotless. This is going to be a lot easier. And do I go do that? And if you're living in Ephesus, your money's likely either Greek or Roman. It's got all sorts of pagan symbols on it. I know the temple doesn't accept my money, but I don't have an Israeli shekel because I'm not living anywhere near Israel. And so when you get to the temple and need to make an offering and aren't allowed to give the Roman or Greek coins, well, I need to exchange my money in order to do that. So it was really birthed out of a lot of practicality, and not in a way that was even all that amoral. I think there was a desire to make worship possible or easier or less kind of a wild card of outcomes, and to allow people to go, hey, we want you to offer the spotless lamb. We want you to do the obedient thing. Here, we're going to make this available for you here. Now, the difficulty is who's over the sacrifices in Jerusalem? Who are the ones who have to approve of these animals? Priests. Who are the ones who have to approve the coins? Priests, yeah. who's probably over now the raising of these animals and this whole process? Priests, yeah. And who's controlling all the sacrifice system to begin with? Right. So it is right. Is there any way to get this ringing out? It is ready for corruption. Whenever there's sort of a monopoly, and at some point the people in the monopoly are not so great, it just goes south. And so there's all sorts of historical records, high inflation, there's called the booths of Ananus, these different booths that, that they were making incredible profits from the people. And it led to a lot of accusations of corruption, particularly against the poor, which is why I think Matthew mentions the pigeon booths. Not only that, but here's a picture of the temple, or at least a little model of the temple. It's kind of this really cool model of ancient Jerusalem that's there right in Jerusalem. And this was Herod's temple at Jesus' time. And so you have the inner temple actually area where the building is and a couple courtyards right there, kind of the smaller middle part. The larger flat part all the way around in red is called what's called the Court of the Gentiles. So if you were a God-fearing Gentile, so you're a Gentile who thinks Yahweh is the Lord and he's the Lord alone, but I'm a Gentile, not a Jew, I'm not going to go through circumcision, I don't feel like I have to be converted to Judaism to worship Yahweh, this is a place for you. You can go and worship, you can do your offerings somehow through this process as well. If people were curious about Yahweh, this is where they would go to find out more. This is where they could see the temple, see what this God's about. Maybe people that are even polytheistic and wanted to make an offering to Yahweh while they're in town and then go back and make their offerings when they're out of town. So there's a place for people to engage and see what Yahweh, his temple, maybe even his people were like. That's what the Court of the Gentiles was available for. Jews would walk through it on their way in. Now, the difficulty, and other gospel writers will point this out, but it's really the only place that's an option, is that all the booths start being set up in this area. And so the place that was set aside for Gentiles to come see what God is like, maybe even worship God himself, are sort of taken over. Like the opportunity for an outsider to be curious and find out more about God is completely, in some ways, desecrated. And this whole like desecration of the temple is a very prophetic thing. Jeremiah, Isaiah, others come along and they're like, look, the temple has become a place of injustice, exploitation. That's why Jesus actually quotes Jeremiah 7 when he says it's a den of robbers. He's speaking very prophetically against this place because the temple should be a place for people to know what God's like. This is a place of justice. It's where all the generosity is actually delved out to people that were in poverty. It's a place of prayer and worship, not a center of profit making. And so Jesus comes in and is passionate about the sacredness of this temple. And his anger, yes, is towards the commercial activity going on, but it also seems very clearly directed towards the leadership and those who are following that leadership. And let's be real, this is where poor leadership ends up. It leads to abusive leadership, complicit followers, and those who are rejected and hurt by all of it. And it comes certainly still into our time, right? Let's deal with leadership first. Perhaps Jesus will show up to many of our churches because it's just of awful, abusive, marginalizing leadership that's happening. Like, I see it too. I pull up things that scandal after scandal and going on in churches. I see denominations covering up abuse. I see pastors idolized yet are complicit in crimes that have been going on in their churches. Watch people reprioritize instructions of Jesus about loving your neighbor in a way that doesn't seem to reflect Jesus at all. We see leadership get identified as God's anointed. Therefore, any criticism or critique or accusations is just not allowed because, hey, they're the anointed ones. We can't accuse them of these things. We watch all these things happen. And not only that, but there's the cultures and those that follow or are part of the systems who are happy at churches, and this is many of us, like I experience this too. Happy at churches that meet all of our specific needs and conveniences, as long as it's on my terms. Often not a culture where we think about others' preferences or how things will affect others around us, causing others to feel isolated or outside, right? Like to be real right now, I love that we hired Sing. Sing's been amazing. I love that our energy in worship has like gone up. But with all that, our volume has gone up, right? And I want our worship to have the energy it has, to have sort of, like, some of these songs are so celebratory, yet, like, sometimes we used to kind of, like, sing the song all about the joy of the Lord, but it was, like, felt like a dirge. And I love that we can celebrate and sing these songs that are celebratory, but I also want to be mindful that, like, there's sensory needs, and there's those who, like, don't feel like they can worship in the room anymore because we're so loud, and I don't know what the answer is. And same thing, like, there's we want to be a church that's thinking about the next generation. We want to be a church that engages with millennials into Gen Z and into Gen Alpha or whatever it's going to be called. Like, we want to be that. But we also want to be a church where those that are 60 plus also have a home here. So, like, we're like, we want you on Slack, but then there's a whole generation that goes, I cannot figure out the Slack thing. And it's like, we want both. And we want to think about both, and we want to care about both. And so I would argue if we become the culture that's always thinking of the other, we'll get to the right place somehow. But perhaps there's a way that we just like our conveniences as long as they're kind of in our direction and not consider the implications. Perhaps just parking further away on a Sunday so those that might be experiencing disability or have really little kids can park up front. Or perhaps we consider the playlist of our neighbors who may worship to a very different style than we might worship to, or might not be the same favorite songs that they have. And we think about our music as hospitality or mission as well. We think about the other all the time. Did you know the Hebrew word for worship is actually the word also for service? So maybe we just call them service gatherings. This is a gathering where we can go serve each other. We serve the Lord and go serve each other. And the church already calls it services anyway, so let's just keep going with that theme. But let's also be real that all sort of the brokenness of the church has a real effects. I've walked through it. I've seen plenty of people firsthand walk through it. The whole movement of deconstruction. And some people want to say, well, deconstruction people just want to be worldly in their sin. And it's just bogus. I just don't think that's a really good argument. Like, I have conversations. That's never the driving point. I think what it is people have watched abuse and hypocrisy by church leadership. They've watched the self-centeredness and hypocrisy of the church people. And they say, this is an institution that's supposed to be for healing, to heal like Jesus. But all it does is hurt and wound. Why would I ever want to be a part of that? And I understand people walking away. Like, I got a good friend who served as an elder under Mark Driscoll's pretty abusive leadership. And then he moved here and served under leadership that at the time was very unhealthy as well and very similar. Just beat up. And he wants nothing to do with the church anymore. And I 100% get it. My heart breaks. I wish he didn't have that experience. I would love for him to come back. But I could sit there and go, I get that. I would, if I were you, I would run far away too. Because the church has done nothing but abuse you. When people in poverty are taken advantage of by prosperity gospel preachers, when people questioning their sexuality are immediately labeled and removed from the church, people who struggle with deep, legitimate doubts are not offered space to actually wrestle with their faith, people are suffering are given platitudes and dismissiveness about their own hurt. And those experiencing disability arrive only to an inaccessible building. When those who have mental health struggles are completely misunderstood and often told, just pray it away. When the very place of worship becomes the least likely place for people to know and experience what God are doing, then what are we doing? And I'm curious what Jesus would come in. And I want to internalize this. I think it's really easy to be like, I know what Jesus will flip over at that other church. But what do they do here? What tables need to be overturned here or in our own individual lives, in our hearts? But Jesus goes out of town to the burbs and stays the night, the next day returns to the city and has this whole fig tree experience. It's unique. He has this sort of weird temper tantrum, but it's interesting because a number of commentaries I read, they really want to like be like, this is Jesus just pointing out that the Israelites are done with and he's moving on to the Gentiles. And I'm like, that ends up being a pretty anti-Semitic theology. And B, the fig tree is never once in the Old Testament connected to Israel. It just isn't. You get olive trees, you get sometimes a pomegranate tree, you get vines and grapes, and that's certainly very connected to Israel, Hebrew thought, but not the fig. And actually, historically, the fig has a very different role coming out of Proverbs 27. Whoever tends a fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who guards or serves, is also that flexible word, his master will be honored. And this verse out of historical Jewish teaching actually gets connected to like spiritual leadership. The word serve is rab. It's actually where we get, the word master is rab. It's actually where we get rabbi. And it became connected historically with leadership. That those who serve under the leadership of the fig tree will eat of the figs of that fig tree. They will eat of that leadership, and good leadership is going to produce sweet and good things. And so that was very much the picture. And so I think Jesus is doing prophetic theater here, which we get out of the prophets. You get the prophets do all sorts of like acts that are symbolic of things that they're ultimately commenting on. And I think Jesus does the same thing here. I think he comes along this fig tree, which these disciples, and I think they get it, would have understood, like, this is a picture of the leaders, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, those who are in authority over the nation right now. And Jesus comes along and says, I'm done with this. I'm done with the fig tree that's here in Israel right now. And his prophetic theater plays out, and the Sadducees will be gone, historically gone, in just a couple decades after this, and be done with. And not only that, but the Sadducees, just to remind ourselves, Sadducees are really a family. So you got a lot of lineages of groups in Israel's history of priests and different families within the priesthood. They're all Levites, but there's like a lot less subsets. And this whole group kind of works with Herod coming off of the Gentile wars and really takes over the temple. And they are... The best way to think about this, I'm half Italian, so I can say this, the stereotype. The best way to think about this is like Italian mafia. That's kind of how they function. They had their own temple guards that were doing all sorts of crazy things and getting people killed all the time. They were just corrupt. Enough that like the Pharisees wanted nothing to do about it, who were sort of a lot of like the pastoral roles in the country. They were sort of the religious leadership, making sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing. There were a little bit of like theological police and behavior police as well. And they get a lot of things wrong too. But they're very different than the Sadducees. Sadducees love power. They love working with Herod. They love the money they get from it. They're fine being buddy-buddy with the Romans as long as they can maintain their position. And this is the Sadducees. And so you get this prophetic act. And I think the disciples actually understand what he says. Because I think ultimately the response is like, hey, Jesus, we get your point. But how is this whole corrupt leadership going to fall? Like, in their minds, the Sadducees, Herod, the whole thing is this powerful group, very wealthy, very influential. What is possibly going to change? It's probably like how some of us feel about politics. It's like, it feels like everything going on in D.C., like, I don't know how that's ever going to change. And I think they're sitting there going, Jesus, how will this possibly change? And Jesus is like, I tell you, if you don't doubt, not only can you do what's done this fig tree, but you can say to this mountain. Now, I think it's important that he uses a definite article, the tuto, this mountain. Because he doesn't say any mountain. He doesn't say go to Stone Mountain, tell it to move, and it's just going to move. He says this mountain. And what's common in rabbinic teaching, and we've seen this in different locations he's been in, is for him to point to something or teach something in the context. So he teaches about millstones in Capernaum, where they literally make millstones. And he teaches about water and stuff when he goes to a well and interacts with it. Like, he's very practical, hands-on of things that are probably right in front of him. So he says, this mountain. Now, guess what? There was a mountain that somebody had literally moved. And that was Herod. And you can see it from pretty far away, especially in a clear day, from anywhere between Bethany and the temple. And so you had this mountain that Herod, who was this paranoid sort of ruler at the time, had moved all this dirt to like a small hill already and kind of built it up and put a palace on time because he needed various fortresses because he didn't know what to do with himself. And so you can look at it and say, like, look, Herod, the powers that be, and this guy who's connected to all this craziness in Jerusalem has moved a mountain before. And so I wonder if Jesus is simply saying, with prayer, guys, even this corrupt leadership that seems to be a stronghold, that seems to be over the temple, even that will be gone one day. It's like, don't tell me that Herod can move a mountain literally just because he has wealth and power. And that a little bit of faith, even like a mustard seed or like yeast, don't tell me that a little bit of faith can't do more than this guy's flesh that he's accomplished. You can take this down. Believe and pray. And I think Jesus is inviting his followers to actually pray against the evil and corrupt kingdoms of this world. I think that is the context of which Jesus makes his statement. And Jesus promises that there will be an outcome to that. And I want to be candid. I just don't think, I want to be cautious to ever apply verse 22 to every prayer, everywhere, at all times. And I appreciate the NIV and CSB that translate slightly different. It says, if you believe, you will receive whatever you ask in prayer. And if that's the phrase, in the context of what he's teaching about the Herodium, then it's a prayer about good triumphing over evil and eventually God's kingdom winning out over the kingdoms of this world. Pray, ask for these things, and Jesus will ultimately answer. And yes, not always in the specific way, but I think this is the context. That prayers against every evil empire and leadership will have the resolution. God will answer those. And guess what? We don't have the Roman Empire anymore and all of its corruption. We don't have the Nazis anymore and all their corruption. Pol Pot's gone. Like, all the historical kingdoms of wickedness and evil have come and gone. There's going to be more, and more people are going to pray about it, and ultimately there's going to be a victory over it. And if that's not even comforting enough, I love what Revelation has to say about our prayers. Revelation 5 says that ultimately all of our prayers, all the things that we have been praying, your prayers, my prayers, our righteous prayers, are being added to a bowl. And God answers some of them right away, but there's just like a collection to be added in Revelation 5, all the prayers of the saints. And then by Revelation 8, it shows a picture that there's going to come a day when the bowls are full. And in some ways, the billions and billions of prayers that I pray, the churches like ours that pray every single week, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your kingdom come, your kingdom come. And the last one of those is going to be prayed, and God's going to look to the angel and say, pour it out on the earth. He's going to take the bowl of prayers like fire, throw it on the earth, and the final purposes of God are going to be achieved, and all of our prayers will be answered in their fullness. So pray. That's the invitation, I think, here. Pray for God's kingdom to come. Pray for God's kingdom to come to your suffering body. Pray for God's kingdom to come to your marriage. Pray for God's kingdom to come to your loneliness. Pray for it to come to your workplace, absolutely. But also pray that the evil and brokenness of this world will be gone and done with. And Jesus, we know, will answer that prayer in the long run. They're never unheard. But all this talk of temples and priests, like, what do they have to do with us? We're not the folks in Jerusalem. And I think the movement from Jesus' death on out matters. It's, Jesus even says in John, look, this temple's going to be destroyed, but I'm going to rebuild it. And he's talking about himself. And then Jesus leaves after his resurrection. And then we get this moment of Pentecost. Now, what do we have when the tabernacle first gets built and dedicated and the temple gets dedicated? What, like, supernaturally happens? Anybody? I feel like, Taylor, you want to answer, but you're afraid to answer. It's like wind and fire and earthquakes and all this kind of stuff. What happens at Pentecost? wind, fire comes down on tongues. It is meant to be seen as this third place movement. We no longer have the tabernacle. We no longer have the temple. But what do we got? We got disciples. And God takes up new residence. 1 Corinthians 3, 1 Peter 2 makes this extremely clear. It's like, y'all are the temple now. Y'all are the place where God's presence dwells. If people are going to encounter God on this earth, it is with us somehow. It's no longer a static building, but an active and living community of believers and a place. As I said, the temple is meant to be the place for people to know what God is like. That's why Jesus is eager to cleanse it and critique it. He's called to purify. And he wants that for his people, to confront our own corruption and go, yes, this is not okay. We got to deal with this. The church should be the place for justice. As I said, the role of the church, or the role of the temple, was where goods were distributed for the care of those who were struggling, suffering, marginalized, all that kind of thing. And that's where this should be now. We are that community that should care for that. It's a place for evangelism. It's a place for people who don't know God to be able to ask questions, to be able to see, to be able to come to understand who God is. And I'm not saying the service. I said the church, like the community, and us as a whole. So I think our call is to examine our temple. Just as Jesus overturned the temple, the tables in the temple, how is our leadership, our culture, our practices? Are we doing things that even out of inconvenience that might be causing others to feel left out, to be unavailable, to see who God is, to worship with his people, causes them to feel like outsiders with no place in the kingdom? Like, would people know what God is like by just observing our community? It's a really important question. Do they see the love of God in us and how we actually treat each other? Do they see the hospitality of our God and how we welcome those who are new or outsiders or just don't, they feel different than us, whatever it may be? They see the impartiality of God, of how revolutionary it was that God invited Jews and Gentiles and slaves and masters and barbarians and Scythians. Do they see that in our community? See the generosity of God and how we provide for others' needs, even sometimes at great cost to ourselves. They see the value of every human life and how we treat and think about others. They see the value we put on our bodies and how we think about how we use our bodies in various ways. They see people who are fervent in prayer, trusting that God can move mountains. And even if some of these things go, yeah, I'm not sure if they see that yet. Do we have faith to believe that by praying to God, he can emanate his presence through us anyways? So I need you to hear, Jesus has zeal for you. Jesus has zeal for this place. He wants to purify us. And the question is, what are the money changers? What are the distractions that we need to drive out with him by confession, by repentance, and all the good practices? Identify them, own them, bring light to those dark things. Because we may remember that, like, as much as all this feels like a weight, and we should. There's some seriousness to God's people and his temple. But Jesus is the temple builder. He's the one that says, I'm going to rebuild the temple. He's the one that says, I build my church. And even better, he's the priest over it all. The role of the priest was to make atonement, to make sacrifices, so the people would be cleansed. And according to Jesus, and particularly in the book of Hebrews, the cleansing's been done. We don't have to figure out how to navigate atonement. We don't have to show up at any temple with our offering and hope that's going to work. It's done. Jesus accomplished that part. And now he's like, I'm making a whole new thing. You guys, you are my dwelling place. So go into the world, reflecting who I am, showcasing who I am, caring for the things I care about. That's how we're going to change this world. That's how mountains are going to be moved.